This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Rockefeller won't run again. Treasury kills the trillion-dollar coin, and the president calls on Congress to pony up. It's Wednesday, and time for a
deadbeat
edition of the Political Junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
Oops.
But I'm the decider.
The president proposes new gun laws and signs 23 executive orders. Ken Salazar opens up another seat in the cabinet. Mark Sanford will hit the campaign trail for Congress. Republicans retreat after House Democrats push through $51 billion for Sandy relief. And the presidential limo gets a payout of taxation without representation license plates. It's Wednesday. Political junkie Ken Rudin is with us, as usual, to review the week in politics. In a few minutes, we'll focus on the task of writing a second inaugural address with former presidential speechwriters Paul Glastris and Peter Robinson, plus Iran's role in the upcoming confirmation hearings for would-be secretaries Kerry and Hagel. Zbigniew Brzezinski will join us. But first, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us here, as usual, in Studio 3A. And trivia in just a moment. Ken, we have two new stations to welcome today.
Yes, and I don't have that piece of paper in front of me.
I do. It's okay. KUT in Austin, keeping Austin even weirder.
A great station, by the
and
way.
And Michigan's Upper Peninsula will join us. That's WGGL.
Okay, that's great.
So how about that trivia question, Ken? Nice you're prepared for that.
Yeah. The trivia question is, why doesn't Ken know the new stations?
Yeah,
that's very exciting news. But the trivia question, at least what I know, is West Virginia Democrat Jay Rockefeller announced last week that he'll not seek a sixth term next year.
How'd you pronounce that? Rockefeller?
Rockefeller.
As in most happy fella?
Well, you remember Nelson Rockefeller campaigning in New York? Hiya, fella.
Hiya, fella. There you go. How am I doing? That was
it's my, yeah. It's my New York accent. Congresswoman Shelley Moore Capito, a Republican, has announced her candidacy, and she has a good shot at winning the seat. No Republican, as you well know, has won a West Virginia Senate seat since 1956. That's not the trivia question. The trivia question is, who was the last female Republican member of the House to be elected to the Senate?
If you think you know the answer to this week's trivia question, the last female Republican member of the House of Representatives to be elected to the United States Senate, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Of course, the winner gets not only a free Political Junkie T-shirt, but that fabulous Political Junkie No Prize button.
Are there T-shirts being given out later today?
Later today, yes indeed. There's going to be an event right here in Washington, D.C. at the 6th and I Synagogue Auditorium, where it's going to be the Political Junkie Roadshow Inauguration Edition.
I'm going to be there. It sounds exciting. I'm going to listen in.
You're going to pay anyway.
Oh, boy, they'll pay, all right.
Well, let's start with that seat in West Virginia. This is going to be one of those seats maybe difficult for the Democrats to hold on to. They, again, the math gives them difficulty. Come 2014, holding on to the Senate.
That's absolutely true. I mean, of course, we said that the Democrats would have difficulty holding on in 2012, and they did just very fine. Thank you very much. And the point, and also in West Virginia, as I said, the Republicans haven't won a Senate seat there since 1956. However, of all the states, it seems like West Virginia is turning more and more red, even if perhaps the country may be turning a little more blue, as we saw in 2012 presidential election. The state went 62-36 for Mitt Romney. President Obama lost every county in West Virginia. So Shelley Moore Capito, who's the daughter of former Governor Arch Moore, thought to be a very capable candidate, and she is. But conservatives are not crazy about her, so there might be a challenge to her from her right. There's also a bunch of Democrats, of course, who are talking about running Cart Goodwin, who is briefly an appointee to the Senate after Robert Byrd died, Congressman Nick Rahal. There's a bunch of Democrats who are looking at that seat as well. But right now, a good possible pickup for the Republicans.
And in the meantime, what the president said today about gun legislation, that's the kind of thing that will drive West Virginia Democrats up the wall.
Well, I think one of the Democrats absolutely to watch is Joe Manchin, who, of course, does not have a re-election problems. He was re-elected, in 2012.
To the Senate just this year.
To the Senate, yeah. Or as we call it, 2012.
Yes.
We know where the House is not going to pass assault weapons ban. That's clear. And of course, Dianne Feinstein and the Chuck Schumers from the urban states will, of course, keep proposing pro-restrictions restrictions on guns. But it is the Joe Manchins of the world. It's the Mary Landrieus of Louisiana who are up in 2014. It's Kay Hagan of North Carolina, Mark Pryor of Arkansas. And what about Harry Reid? When Harry Reid, the majority leader, was campaigning for re-election in 2010, he stood very strong with the NRA. A lot of the commercials showed him with a gun and all that. And, of course, he used a lot of that NRA support to win re-election in what was going to be a very tough race. So Harry Reid has always opposed assault weapon bans, but of course the president offered suggested other remedies, including the assault weapon ban.
And he shares your political analysis. He said even if it passes the Senate, it would have a large, it could not get through the House of Representatives. And he said, given that, his priority is going to be on immigration reform and not gun laws.
Yes, but I also wonder that maybe he threw out everything possible. I mean, obviously, people are still recoiling from the horror of Newtown, and of you think of all the other horrific shootings in the past, Aurora and Columbine and Virginia Tech and all that, and but you think maybe this time it made a difference. But he did talk about increased and unilateral background checks. You did talk about closing loopholes. I wonder if there could be some kind of compromise with Republicans on that issue, at least.
And some people think that the big lobbyists, the NRA, are shooting themselves in the foot.
Ooh,
by
don't say that.
Going over the edge. This is an ad that started to be aired, supported by the NRA, as of last night.
Are the president's kids more important than yours? Then why is he skeptical about putting armed security in our schools when his kids are protected by armed guards at their school? Mr. Obama demands the wealthy pay their fair share of taxes, but he's just another elitist hypocrite when it comes to a fair share of security, protection for their kids, and gun-free zones for ours.
Most people's kids, of course, don't get specific death threats.
No, and most people's kids are not children of the President of the United States who deserve and get 24/7 security. The White House immediately went ballistic. Today, Jay Carney said it was repugnant and cowardly to try to hide behind the president's children. But I think the NRA was trying to make the point that this is not about safety, really. It's just about hypocrisy, because the NRA does want an armed guard in every school. But then what about an Aurora movie theater? Or what about a shopping center in Tucson? I mean, you can't have armed guards everywhere.
Or the firefighters who responded to that.
Exactly.
In Webster, New York. In the meantime, we have some people on the line who think they know the answer to this week's trivia question, and that is the last Republican member of the House of Representatives to be a female and also then be elevated to the United States Senate. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk at npr.org. We'll start with Sue, and Sue's on the line from Boise.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Sue. Go ahead. What's your guess?
Oh, my golly. I missed, I thought it was Barbara Mikulski, then I thought it was Barbara Boxer, and now I realize I'm wrong on both counts because it's a Republican. So my apologies.
That's okay. And you're right. You're wrong.
Sorry.
That's okay, Sue. Try again. Thanks very much for the call. Let's see if we go next to Joel. Joel's on the line with us from San Carlos in California.
Yeah, I'm going to guess Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire.
Kelly Ayotte.
Kelly Ayotte was the state attorney general of New Hampshire when she was elected to the Senate, not a member of Congress.
Could have had the kiss of death by appearing on this program, but won anyway. Thanks very much, Joel.
Thanks.
All right, let's see if we go next to this is Audrey, and Audrey is on the line from Minneapolis.
Yeah, hi. One of my goals in life is to get one of those political junkie T-shirts and be on the Wall of Shame. So I'm going to guess Margaret Chase Smith.
Margaret Chase Smith is an excellent guess. As a matter of fact, she was the first Republican female from the House who was elected to the Senate. As you well know, it was in Maine in 1948, but not the last.
Audrey, you know, those T-shirts are for sale. Just go to the NPR website.
She deserves like maybe a half a T-shirt from Margaret Chase.
Well, Margaret Chase, that's a good. Anyway, Audrey, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Better luck next time. Let's see. We go next to this is Clayton. Clayton with us in Wichita.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Olympia Snow.
Olympia Snow is the correct answer.
Ding, ding, ding.
Of Maine of 1994.
Wow, my lucky day.
But what's interesting is that Margaret Chase Smith and Olympia Snow, both from Maine, were the only female Republican House members elected to the Senate.
Well, congratulations,
like
Clayton. Stay on the line. We will collect your particulars and be bundling you off a T-shirt of the correct size and, of course, that fabulous no prize button.
And I'll send you a picture right away.
All right. That'll be posted on our wall of
Can
shame.
Can you also send a picture of Audrey from Minnesota? Just give her this, because she really should be on the Hall of Fame, even though.
Thanks, Clayton. We're not going to hold you there. All right. In the meantime, a political comeback. Mark Sanford on the these jokes are going to be inevitable. The comeback trail.
Yes. Well, yeah, I did smile when you said that earlier. Now, this is the seat that he previously held in Congress from 1995 to 2000. And he left after 2000 and was elected governor in 2002. He was talking about a White House bid when, of course, he disappeared from South Carolina for 6 days in 2009, ostensibly hiking the Appalachian Trail, but really in South Korea to meet his soulmate.
No. Buenos Aires to meet the Argentine firecracker.
Right,
that was another scandal.
Wilbur Mills. But anyway, so he did have scandal, and a lot of people saying, well, South Carolina will never forgive him. Of course, South Carolina did vote for Newt Gingrich, the three-time married Newt Gingrich, when he won the Republican presidential primary in 2012. But there is a primary on March 19th. There are about a bunch of candidates getting in, and Mark Sanford does have a good shot at finishing on top because he has the most money, the most name recognition. The fear, of course, for him is that there will be an April 2nd runoff, and one against one, that could be his defeat.
In the meantime, President Obama criticized for too many white men appointed to his new cabinet position, said, well, keep tuned. Well, we're keeping tuned. There's a new cabinet position just opened up. Ken Salazar will step down as Secretary of the Interior.
Yes, and you know that he is a Latino member, and he quits for today as Secretary of Interior. He announced that today he is the sixth cabinet official to leave, and of course, one of them, who is leaving, Hillary Clinton, has agreed to testify about Benghazi next week before the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
And another who's up for Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, got a big endorsement. Chuck Schumer of New York. If Chuck Schumer is going to vote for him, that clears the way with most Democrats, wouldn't you think?
Well, the Jewish and Israel issue, yes, but it's really the Republicans who have the most problem with Chuck Hagel, and those are the people who will be watching the John McCain's, the Lindsey Graham's, those types.
But we'll have more on that later today when we talk with Zbigniew Brzezinski, the former National Security Advisor, who says those hearings for Chuck Hagel and John Kerry should be a good place to talk questions about Iran. Anyway, more on that later. Political junkie Ken Rudin is going to stay with us here in Studio 3A. When we come back, we're going to be talking with our favorite presidential speechwriters, Paul Glastris and Peter Robinson, about the task of writing a second inaugural address. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's Wednesday. That means political junkie Ken Rudin is here. And Ken, was there a scuttlebutt winner this past week?
Actually, I'm glad you asked, Neil. There was. There was a bunch of buttons. The first one was a picture button of Sinatra. And, of course, ultimately it came to, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, uh-huh, leading with a Sinatra button. But most importantly, the winner was Del Atwood. Now, I'm sure you're going to ask me, is he the same Del Atwood who's a judge on the Provincial Court and Family Court of Nova Scotia in Canada?
That was on the tip of my tongue.
That is the same. That is the same.
Same
one.
Lee Atwood.
Del Atwood.
Uh-huh.
So he is the winner.
Oh, not Lee Atwood.
No.
Different
no.
fellow. Okay.
No.
Anyway, congratulations to him. And of course, those who solve the scuttle button puzzle, again, get that free political junkie T-shirt.
But he'll be the first Canadian winner, and a lot of people consider Canada.
Well, then we have to trim off 2% of that button when we send it to
them. Well, a lot of people consider Canada a separate country.
That's true. Did you manage to get a column up this week?
There is one, Desiree, all about Mr. Chuck Hagel.
Chuck Hagel, yes. More about that. Anyway, you can see the new scuttle button puzzle and this week's column at politicalnpr.org/junkie. Our Political Junkie Roadshow, again, is tonight, January 16th, here in Washington, D.C. You can join us for an evening of, elevated humor and maybe a good one here and there. Special guests including Ari Shapiro, Don Gagne, and Eric Deggans, plus, of course, trivia and scuttlebutt. Of course, Paul Glastris will be there as well. If you'd like to attend the event,
members of Congress,
buy a ticket, send us an email with Junkie Roadshow in the subject head, and the address, of course, is talk@npr.org. Almost 4 years ago that President Obama was sworn into office the first time, some of us might like to think we remember that day and that speech fairly well. But maybe the only memorable first inaugural moment happened as Justice John Roberts administered the oath of office.
That I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
the office of President of the United States
faithfully.
and embarrassed Justice Roberts came back the next day to issue the oath with all the I's dotted and the T's crossed. And, of course, the actual swearing-in is Sunday. So, Ken Rudin, who's the last president who will be actually sworn in four times?
Well, of course, one would think it would be Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was elected four times. But because President Obama was sworn in and then sworn in correctly, and then he'll be sworn in Sunday, which is, of course, a Sunday.
Right.
And therefore, the big public swearing in is on Monday.
So, ding, ding, ding.
President Obama will be a four-time inauguree.
Monday, the festivities and the parade, of course, the inaugural balls will take place, and the big speech. In a moment, presidential speechwriting duo Paul Glastras and Peter Robinson to talk about the hopes and challenges of a second inaugural address. But we'd also like to hear from you. If you're a speechwriter who's had to write speeches for one person over a long time, how do you keep it fresh? Tell us what works and what doesn't. Our number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation on our website as well. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And Paul Glastras and Peter Robinson are here with us again. Paul Glastras wrote speeches for Bill Clinton. He's currently editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back, Paul.
Great to be here.
Peter Robinson is a speechwriter for Ronald Reagan and joins us from the campus at Stanford University, where he's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. Peter, welcome back to you as well.
A pleasure.
And Paul Glastras, let's start with you. What's the most important item for next week's speech?
Well, you know, there have been 16 second inaugural addresses in all of our history, and there's a certain pattern to them. And what I've noticed is they encapsulate the philosophy of the president at that moment in time. And I expect what we'll see from President Obama is an encapsulation of his idea of the role of government in American society, very much informed by his reelection and very much informed by the tussle with Republicans at this moment and the specific agenda items he has before him.
So, Peter Robinson, specific agenda items, isn't that what he's going to wait for the State of the Union message for?
Well, I'm hoping that Paul is correct. Sure, you'd put your laundry list of specific agenda items in the State of the Union address, but I'm hoping Paul is correct in that Barack Obama will tell us what he wants to do with this second term. I just looked over some second inaugural addresses, Reagan's, Clinton's, George W. Bush's. Only one of them was better than the first address, and that was the address by George W. Bush, where he said, "For half a century, America defended our own freedom by standing watch on distant borders. After the shipwreck of communism came years of relative quiet, and then there came a day of fire." Of course, what had happened between the first address and the second address was 9/11, and that gave shape and purpose to George W. Bush's second term, to his entire presidency. I myself, now here I am, I'm a Republican, I'm a conservative, I'm a Reagan guy. I don't quite get what Barack Obama thinks he wants to do. Since the election, he has been, you'd expect people to be a reelected president to be conciliatory, to embrace the other side, to say, let us go forward together. And yet, since the election, he's been quite sharp and quite aggressive and quite partisan. And so I guess what I'm saying is I hope, even as Bush placed his presidency in American history by saying, I am now going to promote a freedom agenda throughout the world, I am hoping that Barack Obama tells us what he sees the second term as being about.
Well, conciliatory with malice towards none has been taken. But Ken, you had a question.
Well, Peter, that's a good point, because I was thinking, I also read a bunch of inaugural speeches, second ones over the last couple of weeks.
He did his homework?
I did.
You would,
Ken.
You would.
Except for those two stations that we brought on. But I was thinking that, too, that, you know, I mean, even when Reagan had his, you know, inauguration in 81, he never mentioned the hostages. Nixon never mentioned Vietnam or Watergate. But President Obama said to Republicans the other day, he said, you know, if I'm going to have a fight with you over the debt ceiling, if I'm going to have a fight with you over guns, I'm going to use the State of the Union, and I'm going to use the inauguration as a bully pulpit. I've not seen that a president do that. Usually they're far more conciliatory.
Yeah. And I think back to, seems to me there's a lot of free-floating anxiety in the country right now. So some sense, here we have a central national moment. Will he use it to tell us how he intends to put the... Will he use it to reassure us? There's the obvious anxiety that people are still terribly concerned about the economy. Lots of people just out of work. But I myself sense a kind of a second sort of anxiety that in one way or another, our fundamental institutions just aren't working, that the American project is getting old and beginning to break down. Will he address those? Will there be something as ringing and memorable and reassuring as Franklin Roosevelt's, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself"?
Now, that was in his first inaugural, but Paul Glasnow.
Right.
Well, you know, there you can go back in time and find presidents who were much more feisty and pugilistic in their second inaugural addresses. Ulysses S. Grant is one.
Ken read that one.
I saw it on CNN.
But in fact, Thomas Jefferson was very aggressive and slightly grumpy in his second inaugural address. He'd gone through a tough reelection. Things were, as they are now, very, very partisan, very, very bitter. It may be appropriate at this moment for the president to address the elephant that's in the room, the fact that our system is not in harmony, rather than gloss over it with the kind of usual boilerplate about us working together when we know we're not right now.
Come Monday, there will then be 17 American presidents who've enjoyed a second inaugural. You've had the good fortune to work for two of them. How did it work? Every speechwriting team is different. I get that. But Paul Glasnow, for Bill Clinton's second inaugural, did somebody draft a speech? They sent it around. Who marked it? How's it work?
My old boss, Michael Waldman, had a heavy hand in it. I was not there at the time, but Bill Clinton takes a very, very a direct role in his speech writing, especially these big speeches.
He wants to add a paragraph or two.
Oh, he'll rewrite every sentence as it's written. It's, you know, he gets a draft. He'll mark it up. There'll be several drafts after that. And then over the course of several days, standing in front of a podium and a group of senior staff members, he'll read and revise and revise and revise till the speech is very much his own. And that speech, his second inaugural, was very much a speech about the role of government and encapsulated sort of the new democratic philosophy that had won in the reelection.
Peter Robinson, what about President Reagan's team?
President Reagan was a different kind of figure from Bill Clinton, of course, in that he'd spent 3.5 or 4 decades as a public speaker and, of course, was a professional trained actor before becoming president. So that the second inaugural was Ben Elliott, the chief speechwriter. Peggy Noonan wrote a couple of drafts. As I recall, Ken Kachigian came in from... So there were about 3 speechwriters, and it went to the president, and he made a few minor changes. I don't know that he even... I don't think there was a public rehearsal. He very seldom, if ever, actually, thinking back on it, did a public rehearsal. The president would sit with a text, mark it up himself, and then he would be ready to go, even if it was a second inaugural address where the entire world would be watching. One run through in his mind with the text typically did the trick. But I'm struck. Paul mentioned that Clinton used his second inaugural address to talk about the role of government. And, you know, Reagan did a little bit of that, too. He repeated his fundamental belief in limited government. So it was, in a very quiet way, ideological or principled. He was laying out, as Clinton did, his understanding of the role of government. Mm. I want Barack Obama to do this for us. I'd like to know what's in his head.
Ken?
Well, Paul and Peter just mentioned that both Presidents Clinton and Reagan had drafts to work from. And I always thought the only person president with a draft was William Henry Harrison. But that's a great joke, but I'll describe it later. But here's the thing he died.
Paul and I are laughing.
You're laughing inside. But anyway, my question is that we think of all these great, you know, we think of Kennedy, S. Not Would Your Country, and FDR, but for the most part, I can't recall even great orators who were presidents. I can't recall their inaugural addresses, first or second. Why is that? And is it about me?
And of course, including the ones that you guys had.
No, but I mean, you think of how great speeches, but not the inaugural addresses so much.
Other than Lincoln's.
You're right.
I think they're probably
most
more...
of them are no good. truly, if you just sit down, as you apparently have done, Ken and Paul, if you read the inaugural addresses, they're interesting in some one way or another. The historic Jefferson is fascinating to see what was in his head and how that played out in his term. But most of them as rhetoric are just remarkably dull speeches.
I think that if State of the Unions are too close to the ground in terms of laundry lists of policies, inauguration addresses are maybe too far above the ground. And they almost always aim to place the president in the grand scheme of American history. And that can be a little tedious.
We're talking with former presidential speechwriters, Paul Glastris. You just heard Peter Robinson is with us from Stanford. We want to hear from those of you who have written speeches as well, particularly for people addressing the same audience over and over again, whether that's stockholders or the nation. 800-989-8255. How do you keep it fresh? What works? What doesn't? Email us talk@npr.org. It's Wednesday. Political junkie Ken Rudin is with us as usual, and it's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Monica. Monica's on the line with us from Arkansas.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I am a speech writer for a national sports and fitness figure. And I've written speeches for people, you know, for years, but just started this more national account. And it's an interesting animal because this person basically has the sports and fitness version of the political stump speech. It's more or less the same speech given all over the nation, sometimes even in other countries. And I have to come up with ways to make it fresh because oftentimes the same people are standing in the audience.
Monica, Lance is going to need some serious help.
It takes a lot of effort as far as keeping that relationship with the person fresh, making sure that I am in constant conversation with him, trying to get deeper and deeper into what he thinks, what he means, how he feels about certain issues.
Well,
and then also I use a lot of metaphors to try to get things across. New ways of saying the same thing, basically.
Well, Peter Robinson, the president, has the same, I guess, advantage and problem. By now, his ideas are familiar. On the other hand, by now, his ideas are familiar.
Exactly. Has he ever? When I was in the White House, I spent a year and a half working for Vice President George H.W. Bush before moving to the president's staff. And the vice president was a dream to work for. He was difficult to work for in the sense that he was not the most talented giver of speeches, so you'd cringe sometimes to hear what he did with your text. But with the vice president, you could use the same material over and over again because nobody ever paid any attention to what he said. You were safe. But with the president, man, every speech had to be fresh.
Yeah, read that my is lips. You can't do that
problem.
Again. Yeah. Paul Glastris, the same problem, keeping it fresh.
Well, that's right. We had one speechwriter in our office who had a T-shirt with a recycling sign on it because we use so many of the same phrases over and over again. Part of that is strategic because, sure, you may have given a speech 100 times, but 99% of the public still hasn't heard it. So repetition is very important in the role of speeches, which is to move policy.
Those who have stood behind the rope line in the press corps and heard that same speech 100 times until they can recite it along with the candidate, they're rolling their eyes a little bit. Monica, thank you very much for the call. Good luck with your speech.
Thank you.
Here's an email that we have from Jerry in Woodside, New York. I hate to say the number one thing that a speech needs, I have to say, he says, is some humor. Most people are not political junkies. They care a lot less about politics than we think we want them to. Mm-hmm. So the key is finding a way to engage them, even non-funny jokes. Well, Ken would know all about that. Show people you're trying to connect with them and they appreciate it. An inaugural address, though, it's a pretty formal occasion,
Paul
Glastris.
No, it is not a time for humor. I wouldn't advise using that. But, you know, maybe the two greatest second inaugural addresses, Abraham Lincoln's and FDR's, were both very focused. Lincoln spoke about nothing but the war, right? And that's the speech that, you know, we remember with malice toward none, with charity toward all. Roosevelt's was completely and totally about the role of government, breaking with the past, using government and melded with science and democracy to lift the nation up. And that's where he talked about a nation ill-clad, ill-fed, and so forth. So if President Obama can focus on one big thing rather than being diverted to a bunch of things.
So this is a hedgehog speech. It's not a fox
speech.
There you go. Yeah, there you go.
I would agree. I go back to George W. Bush. He's an unpopular figure. The war went badly. We know all that. But as a speech, his second inaugural address, which is quite brief and very tightly focused on the freedom agenda, the survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands. Exactly what Paul said. If in a second inaugural address you can achieve focus, this is what my presidency is about. This is where I intend to take the country. then Barack Obama will have given a good address.
Thank you both, as always, for your time today, and we will look forward to the second inaugural address by President Barack Obama come Monday after he's sworn in for the third time on Sunday and fourth time on Monday. Paul Glastris was a speechwriter for former President Clinton. He joined us here today in Studio 3A. Peter Robinson, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, a speechwriter for former President Reagan. He joined us from a studio at the Stanford University campus. Ken Rudin, our resident political junkie, joined us here in Studio 3A as usual. See you tonight at the 6th and I Synagogue.
Yep.
And, of course, again, right here next week with more sparkling dialogue and all the stations that have joined us. After a short break, former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski will join us with some tough questions for cabinet hopefuls. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.